and but we'll sort of go freewheeling, yeah, or whatever right. comes up, I'll just get back. Then usually people, I start on the first couple, and they kind of end up, everything comes out at
once,
so that's
it's
fine.
True.
Don't worry, there's nothing like particular, you know, there's no real particular order that has all to right. be or anything. And if I ask you anything that you don't want to answer, just say, you know, I'd rather not talk about that or whatever.
Okay, sure.
I'll try to be. I mean, they are kind of like personal questions to do about some of these things, you know. Yeah. Okay. Well, the first thing I just want to talk about is when did you find out you were HIV positive, and what was that like?
When I found out, I was already full blown. I got pneumonia in July of '91, and I went to the hospital. I knew it was pneumonia. I just didn't know that it was PCP. And when I went to the hospital, they asked whether or not I would consent to be tested because, of course, they didn't know what kind of pneumonia it was, and they were covering all bases. I told them, sure. I had no reason to think I was at risk. My behavior hadn't been at risk. So I told them, you know, sure, go ahead. I signed the consent to be tested. And when they tested me, I was positive. I had PCP, which is by CDC regulations, full-blown AIDS. So that's when I found out. So I never knew about being HIV positive. Yeah.
So you never was checking the numbers. Uh-huh. You had never considered being tested before that at all?
No. Because like I said, you know, my boyfriend and I were together 17 years. And when we broke up, the breakup was very bad. So there was nobody else for me. There wasn't even a thought that I would be interested in anybody else for really a couple of years. And then by the time I you know, started to come out of that and wanted, you know, to look around and see, there were other things happening. I was in a new place, all right, because I was in California, trying to look for a job, set up a household. You know, you kind of get busy and bogged down. So that your personal life you let slide because other things are more important. And so I let it slide. So there was no, but like I said, there was nobody else. So.
So what? How they tell you when you find out the results?
They.
What was it like?
I was. It was well done in a way, and it was badly done. I was. When they tested me, I was out of it. All right, because I'd gotten so bad, both my lungs collapsed. I was on a respirator, and because the respirator had me so agitated, and I was they told me I was trying to pull the tubes out, so they paralyzed me. They put me on morphine. So there are 10 days in my life that I know absolutely nothing about. I was out of it. When I first started to come out of the morphine and was breathing off of the respirator. I heard a conversation referring to me, and I overheard somebody say I was HIV positive. And then a respiratory technician came in later on that day to my room to give me a breathing treatment, and the doctor told him to put on a mask and gloves because I was HIV positive. When the hospital finally officially told me, when they sent a social worker, a doctor, and the chaplain to see me and to talk to me and to tell me, they were very angry when they realized what had happened, because that should never have happened. All right, I shouldn't, because I was so ill. I was three days out of the, I guess, drug-induced coma before they told me, because they were so afraid that the shock would maybe send me back into respiratory arrest. So they wanted that time, and they didn't want to just, you know, give me the news and leave me out there. All right, so they wanted to what they call catch me. So by the time they told me, I'd known for a couple of days already, and I think I took it rather well.
Yeah. How'd you feel? What did you think?
You know, I'll tell you something. You, at first, you really do go numb. I mean, it is a feeling that I can't even describe to you. You literally, everything stops. It's almost like somebody clicks off the clock of time. Everything stops. All right? You don't think. This news is just like, it's like on a marquee in the front of your brain, and it's just running across, and that's the only movement, the only thing that's happening. You don't hear anything. You don't feel anything. And then, you know, slowly you start to come back to yourself, and then there's like this, I think you stop to brace yourself for the pain that's coming. All right, because it's like a shock of pain. It's like somebody punched you or something like that. I mean, you know, first, like I said, first it's like stop, then pain, you know, and then you kind of catch yourself, and as the days go by, you cry, you know, the pain comes back, you get angry, all these things come up. All right, but you know, usually they don't. Well, for me, they didn't come up all at once. They came up periodically, you know, as they came up and, you know, you deal with them.
So what did you know about AIDS or think about AIDS prior?
I happened to have had a friend who was an AIDS outreach counselor and an AIDS case manager. When I first came to California, I lived in a single room occupancy for hotel for 6 months till I could put together money and get to know the area. And I met her there. Believe it or not, she came from Brooklyn. Never knew her, even though we do have mutual friends, but I never knew her. And you know, that was a connection. So when we looked around and decided to go to Long Beach, we shared a house. And because we had a deck in the back of the house, sometimes some of her groups would come over and have their support sessions there. So I got to know people with AIDS, mostly gay men. All right, I got to know people with AIDS, and of course I talked, I listened. So I did know quite a bit about AIDS, how you got it, what its consequences were, you know, and I was able to watch, especially two that were friendly with her in general, and they were over at the house often. All right, so I was able to watch the progress with them. You know, both of them have since died. All right, and the progress is told, like, Ernie took a long time. You know, he got TB in and out of the hospital. And he'd be sick and he lost the weight. And at the end he used to walk the streets with his pole and his IV. All right, because nothing would keep him in the house. And he was an American Indian. And finally, when he really got so low, then his people came and got him and took him back to Arizona where he died. Lance was fine right up to, I think, three weeks before he died, because I saw Lance. I was on my way somewhere, and Lance and I rode the bus together. And it couldn't have been more than 2 or 3 weeks later. Donna told me Lance is in the hospital, and before we knew it, Lance was gone.
So you had no warning for yourself and before you got pneumonia?
Nothing that was enough to have me stop and say something is wrong here. You know, and women don't, from what I understand, women don't have the same symptoms. All right, so that a lot of symptoms that women might have, which is a recurring yeast infection, why would you think it was AIDS? You know what I mean? Unless you have something that, and I think that's why women don't live as long, because by the time they know, they're usually full blown. That's usually when it pops up. I think maybe if they get tested before because of the risk, you know, their at-risk behavior or their partner's at-risk behavior, if they know about it, they may find out early. But I think most women don't find out till they're full blown. You know, so no, I can't think of anything. that might have, and I didn't even really had, I mean, I didn't even really have, I don't even remember, not a recurring yeast. I mean, women get yeast infections, all right? And most of the time I would take care of it with cranberry juice and yogurt and keep taking the golden seal and it would go away.
Sure.
All right, you know, I didn't even have to go and get medicine or anything for it, you know? So, hey, like I said, why would I have thought that, you know, this was anything but that?
Can you talk a little bit about how you think you contracted HIV?
I know I got it from my boyfriend. Where he got it and how he got it, like I said, I believe, and to the absence of anything to the contrary, I will believe that he got it sexually. For me to believe he got it using IV drugs, he would have to tell me that. All right. Even if somebody came and said, "Well, I saw him using drugs," I still wouldn't believe it. All right, because he didn't use not IV drugs. All right. So and there was never any evidence of drug use, no tracks or things, you know, on his arms or legs or anything. So like I said, he would have to say, you know, one time, two times. It was a habit, you know, before I met you, whatever, you know. But other than that, I'm sure he got it sexually. Hmm. All right, and I got it from him.
How do you feel about that? You were talking about that before.
Sometimes I'm angry. Of course, sometimes I'm really angry. And then I have to say, you know, he didn't do it deliberately. You know, nobody wants AIDS. And certainly nobody wants to give it to anybody else, and so he didn't get it deliberately. And he's according to what they told me in California, he's got toxoplasmosis. So you know he didn't want that. I am, you know, and hey, life works out. Sometimes it works out in ways you'd rather it didn't work out. And this time it worked out terribly. You know, I'm not pleased at all with how it worked out. But you deal with it, you live with it, you know.
Did you were assuming it was from him because you heard that he was sick, or you were assuming it was from him because he was your only sexual partner?
He was my only sexual partner for 17 years. I seriously doubt that, and before that, I was, I've always taken responsibility for my sexuality, and before that, I made people use a condom because I wasn't interested in getting pregnant, and in those days, all right, birth control pills were still kind of on the iffy side, so it was either condom, and then at some point I got a diaphragm, and I used to use the diaphragm and the spermicide. All right, and but still, like I said, we're talking. I mean, I met him in 1970, so all through the 70s and 80s, I mean, it was just him. So I'm not even, you know, I seriously doubt that anything. You know, I don't even know that AIDS was in existence before the late 70s. You know, so, you know, much less to have contracted it from somebody else, no.
So, did you assumed it was him?
I assumed it was him.
And when did you, how and when did you find out that he was?
Now, I don't know. I would rather this particular part not go on the record because I don't want anybody to get in trouble for it.
Okay, sure.
All
no.
right.
Don't talk about what you don't want to talk about. It's easier to.
Okay.
Talk about
I'm not going to mention any names, all right? What a phone call was made to New York City Health Department when I gave his name, all right? Whoever made the phone call was told, all right, because they gave the name to New York City Health Department. It's like, please get in touch with this person. Tell them that somebody that they've been with has AIDS. And the person in New York City, I don't know where they checked, but they said he's already been diagnosed. And now I don't know, they could have known each other because, you know, it's a small, the healthcare
sure.
AIDS field is small. They could have known each other. So maybe that's how the person got to know that he had been diagnosed and he had toxoplasmosis. I'm not sure that they're supposed to give out that information.
How long was the time period between when you...
When you
came down with pneumonia, when you found out that he was definitely...
A few days.
Oh, only a few days.
Yeah, because they called. They called New York. And they told New York that I don't know if they gave my name, but I gave them his name, and they told New York that one of his sexual partners had AIDS, and asked them to notify him, and then they told them that he had been diagnosed January or February of that same year, and that he had toxoplasmosis. And like I said, I don't know whether this was one colleague who to another colleague, or whether this was officially, all right, whether this was official sanctioned information that they were giving. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why I said, you know, be careful how you use that, because somebody may hear it and may say, hey, you know, they're not supposed to give out this information. And it may have been, you know, one colleague talking to another. They knew each other. So they say, hey, I can tell you this, but, you know, don't say it came from me. Yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, this is sort of in the big question of like what your life was like before and how it changed when you once you came down with pneumonia and knew you were you had. Maybe this is.
Excuse me.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Thanks, Ma. It was not a friendly breakup.
He was diagnosed with AIDS in 91.
91. So was I, but he was January or February, and I was in July.
And you'd broken up when?
87 early. So, you know, there was no contact. And we didn't speak to each other. You know, and then in 88 I moved to California. So there definitely, you know, was a great deal of space between us.
And the relationship had been here in Brooklyn?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'll let you keep going.
Okay, you come. Yeah, sure, you come back to it.
Okay, I just need to know
it's okay.
Where we were.
But that was actually what we're getting into the issue of how your life had changed. But in terms of what your life like was before, were you surprised to find out that he had obviously had other sexual partners?
You know, not. I wouldn't say surprised. You know, in growing up, when I grew up. That doesn't get you bent out of shape. You don't even concern yourself with that as long as the other sexual partners don't interfere in your relationship. You don't even, you know, I mean, you have your life to live. They have their life to live, all right? And if there was a problem, I mean, if the person put something between us, and you can tell, you know, when there's miscommunication or something between you and your lover, you can tell. And if there was that, then I would have probably said, hey, look, is there somebody else in your life? Is something going on that maybe I should know about? But as long as you don't feel that distance in the relationship, you simply don't worry about it. You know, and I never, you know, he never gave me an STD. So again, you don't, you know, it's like, why? What are you looking for? All right, if you don't have a problem, don't make one.
Even with the distance that you have between you after your breakup, how did you feel about him not telling you when he was diagnosed? Was he diagnosed first?
I was PO'd. But then, you know, you have to think about it. How sick was he? Maybe he physically, I don't know. I don't know how sick he is physically. All right. Maybe he asked somebody to get in touch with my family. Maybe they tried and maybe the response that they got, they didn't say anything. You know, maybe they didn't want to talk. Maybe they called my mother's house and was simply told that I wasn't here, didn't leave a I don't know. See, I wouldn't say that he didn't try. You know what I mean? But maybe I wasn't here. All right. The breakup wasn't good. My family has absolutely no use for him. You understand what I mean? So I don't know. Maybe he called and wasn't given a good reception, and maybe he didn't want to say something like that. I think he could have made a better effort, but Listen, I don't know. All right, like I said, not having seen him, for all I know, maybe he's so ill that somebody else is handling his business, you know?
Sure. So what happened? How did your life change? What did you do? It sounds like you went through a lot of changes right after you recovered from your pneumonia.
Well, I was in the hospital for 4 weeks. I was out for two and then back for another week. I was very ill. For one thing, I had to leave California because I couldn't take care of myself when I first came from the hospital. So they brought me back, and I've been living here. And for the first couple of months that I was here, my mother literally took care of me, making all my meals, even simple things like bathing. I mean, I had to be helped in and out of the tub. I had to be helped downstairs. It was a while before I could comfortably come up those stairs. In fact, when I first came, they had to carry me up those stairs because I couldn't come up. And it was a while before I was able to comfortably come up those stairs. Things like, even now that I'm 300% better, but there's no question about me going back to work. I do get fatigued after like 3 or 4 hours of steady activity. Like if I go shopping, I'll go to the mall, I'll go downtown, and if I've been down there 3-4 hours, I'll find myself getting fatigued. That didn't happen before. I don't ride public transportation because there's a TB epidemic. I have no defense against that. So if the crowding and everything else, you just have to be careful as far as microbes and bacteria and germs and things are concerned. You know, you keep your hands washed. All your food has to be well cooked. No soft boiled eggs, no poached eggs, no rare meat, none of that stuff, because if you pick up something, again, you have no defense. So the whole focus of your life changes because you know that you can't take the chances. You can't do things that you used to do without thinking about.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Things like, as you can see, I enjoy eating. All right, so I would never think certain things. I don't like boiled Franks. I would never eat the Franks from the dirty man on the corner, even though most people I know love them. But I wouldn't eat them because I don't like boiled Franks. But if a guy was selling grilled Franks, I'd eat it. You know, the shish kebab on a stick, things like that. You know, you walk down the street, especially New York. New York is a real festival of that kind of thing. All right, and I can't do that anymore. All right, because, hey, I don't know how well this thing has been cooked. And again, I have no defense against anything I may pick up. Like I said, I take taxis or I get a car ride everywhere. You know, my family spoils me. I mean, I do sometimes behave like the brat and take advantage of it. All right, because all I have to do is say, hey, you know, I need to go such and such a place. Oh, they go out of their way to make sure I have transportation to get there. Mm. You know, so.
Well, let's talk about your family a little bit. You know, how did they respond when they found out? And your mother, does your grandfather, you know, all the people in your family?
My grandfather knows, my aunts and uncles know.
How did they react? What happened?
You know, I tell you something, I think that has a lot to do with how well I'm doing. All right, because the support was unconditional and there for me. Like I said, my mother, when I first got really sick, my mother and my sister flew out to California. My brother, I have a brother that lives in St. Louis, he flew out. All right, so that for most of the time I was in the hospital, some member of my family was there with me. You know, so I was never just left to the care of strangers. I had a cousin from, I have a cousins that live up in Hayward, California, which is near San Francisco. They also, you know, would periodically come down. So again, my family was always there.
How do they feel about it being AIDS? I mean, it's a stigmatized disease. You're being heterosexual.
I'm sure. Remember now, they had 10 days to get over it, because see, they had to be told, because I was close. They thought I was going to die. They did not think I would come out of that pneumonia. So my family had to be told, so they had time to get over it. So by the time I knew and I was able to be conscious, you know, I was conscious and I knew and I was told, I think their thing was, whatever they felt about the stigma was not going to be communicated to me. All right, all I would get was the love and the support and we're going to be with you through this. That's all I was going to get. I wasn't going to get any, all the rest of that stuff, they were going to keep to themselves. And they've done that.
Particularly, you know? I know for the exhibit, this particular right. project.
You know, I'll tell you something, all right? This was more of a look on the face. Nobody actually said, are you going to use your name? All right. Nobody actually said, don't use your name. They did ask me, are you going to use your name? And this was more a look on the face, a stiffening body language that let me know that there's a problem here, that they were a little up, you know, that they were worried about their friends and their colleagues.
And what were they worried about?
All right. Well, you know, the stigma. There is, hey, we have to face that. There is definitely a stigma involved. And nobody wants, I mean, I'm their daughter, I'm their sister, I'm their granddaughter, niece. All right. Nobody likes the idea of people looking at me as promiscuous, as immoral. As a lowlife, which is what people, you know, if you have AIDS, a great many people look at you as somebody that, quote, did something to deserve this. You know what I mean? And it doesn't, quite frankly, I don't think anybody, I don't care what you did, you know, I don't care if you slept with three different people, you know, every day for all of your life. You didn't deserve not AIDS. You don't deserve that. All right, but still, you know, people look on it as a punishment for something terrible that you did, and that's the stigma, and you know, the bottom line is, sooner than later, I am going to die and leave it. All right, I'm not going to have to face it, but they'll be left with it. You know, they'll be left to live with the fact that I died of AIDS, with whatever comes along with that. I won't be here. You know, I won't be concerned.
Have you experienced any specific times or your family, you know, where people have given you that kind of their own misinformation, their own prejudices, responding that way?
Not since I've told. You know, not since I've been diagnosed. Not since I've, a few of my friends know. You know, and not since I've talked to them. I haven't had that. Before that, though, and I think they mostly tried to find out, simply because now you know somebody, and you know somebody who is not the stereotypical person that gets AIDS. You know, all of a sudden it's like, how did you get it? All right, so, you know, then they make the effort to find out what the truth is. But before that, I remember a really good friend of mine. We worked together, and we used to go to the same health club. So we would go, you know, after work, we would go together. And she wouldn't use the pool because she was afraid of getting AIDS. You know, I'm like, I would look, I said, you're too educated. You know better than that. I said, you don't get syphilis from a pool. Why would you think you'd get AIDS from a pool? She said, well, they don't really know. And this is the kind of thing that I think it still operates. All right, it doesn't matter. You know, I found one thing about people. If the belief is strong enough, reality has absolutely no effect on it, none. You know, facts don't matter, not if the belief is strong enough. Yeah.
What were you doing for work before? What was your career or your job?
I was an administrative assistant, you know, and I was working mostly temporary at the time. So of course I had no health insurance. All right. So that too is, even if I wanted to go back to work, that's a major consideration, health insurance. All right, because right now I'm getting Medicaid because I'm not working, I'm getting disability from Social Security. All right, so again, the government is taking care of, you know, any medical bills I may have. But if I go back to work, you know, how is that going to affect my health insurance? Because you know nobody's giving it to me, right? You know no insurance, no private insurance company is giving me health insurance. Yeah.
Do you feel like you miss your previous, your old life, the more active life you had, the things you did?
Yes, you do. You do. Believe me, it's great not having to set an alarm clock. It's great getting up in the morning and not having to rush and get up and face rush hour traffic or the subways or whatever. But you miss the day-to-day contact with adults, talking to people. You even miss the job itself because it kept you stimulated. All right, you do miss that. I'm in the process of trying to find out how to put together a newsletter. You know, so maybe I'll get that, you know, put my energies into another kind of activity. You know, but like I said, I seriously doubt that I'll ever, you know, go back to work full time.
What are your, you were talking before about your grandparents, you know, how old they were?
Oh, you know, it runs, longevity happens to run on both sides of the family. My grandfather's gonna be 90 in August. And he's not as active as he used to be, but he's pastor of a church, and the church has a grade school and a nursery school, and he still oversees it. You know, it's part time, you know, 3 or 4 hours every day. But he still takes care of himself. You know, he cooks for himself. He lives in a two-story house, and the bedrooms are upstairs, so he climbs stairs and comes downstairs in the morning. You know, when he goes into the church and he climbs up the stairs to get there. All right, we stopped him driving when he was 85, you know, because it was really getting a little hairy. You know, like I said, he's not as, of course, he's 90 years old. He's not as active as he used to be, but he's still active. He's by no means invalid, senile, or anything else. When my grandmother died at 88, she was fine. She had an aneurysm that ruptured. So she got sick Saturday. The following Friday, she was gone. She was never really sick. And the two of them, I mean, they lived together. They took care of themselves. Sure, we, you know, my aunt and my father and my cousins, you know, they keep an eye on him. You know, they don't leave him alone. Well, the shock of my grandmother's death, he's never really gotten over it. So he's not left alone. You know, we keep a pretty close watch on him. But basically speaking, you know, he's still an independent person.
And you were saying how you feel.
Oh, yeah. And now my grandmother on my mother's side, she was 80 when she died. And so given that kind of track record, all right, I should have lived to be 90. You know, my grandmother also had an aunt that lived to be 101. You know, her own mother lived to be 95. I mean, you know, I was going to live a long time, and now I'm not. You know, and I was telling you, that's a source of anger for me sometimes. All right, you know, the idea that my life is going to be, you know, cut much, much shorter. I mean, I'm 40, I'll be 43 years old. You know, who knows how much longer I have? I mean, at the most optimistic, what do I have? 5 years? You know, and that's being real optimistic. Yeah.
What do you think about when you think about your future, when you think about how you want your life to be over the next few years even?
Over the next few years, I do want to get a little more involved in something. It's possibly going to be AIDS, you know, AIDS related, you know, talking to people. Again, like I said, I'm in the process of pulling together information. I'd like to start a newsletter, you know, something that goes out maybe every month or so, just on general information, you know, things that I found out, the medical things, social service things, you know, who to go to, where to get help, things like that, that people, you know, I happen to be lucky, all right, besides having the family support, my brother's a reporter, all right, so that this is a person who knows where to get information, who knows people that he can call, all right, that will say, okay, you can call here, here's a number, call this person, they can help you. You know, so when I came back to Brooklyn, I was put in touch with a doctor, a hospital. All right, and then they handle the social services aspect. Well, a lot of people don't have that. They're kind of like out there, you know, trying to find out. And you know, if I can use some of, you know, the experience that I didn't have to have, you know, to save people from that kind of hassle, I can, you know, that'll be good.
Are you able, you feel like with Medicaid and Social Security, you're able to get the kind of necessary care that you need? Can you afford what you need to afford?
When I worked, I made a decent salary. So my Social Security is decent. That is, you know, see, again, I'm not getting SSI. I'm getting actual Social Security because I worked. All right. And so that, also, again, my grandfather owns the building, so my rent is not as high as I may have to pay if a stranger was my landlord, you know. My doctor isn't that expensive. I only have to go once a month now. Medicaid and New York State has a program called ADAP. ADAP pays for all my AIDS-related medication, my AZT, my Bactrim. When I have to take something for thrush, that's paid for. Medicaid picks up anything else. Like I have hay fever, so I had to get allergy medicine. All right, Medicaid pays for that. I had an ear infection. Medicaid, you know, picked up my drops and my antibiotic. Things like that. And as far as cash money is concerned, like I said, I'm getting a little more than most people would get. I was on public assistance until Social Security kicked in, and they paid my rent. But other than that, I got like $300 a month and $83 of food stamps. And that ain't a whole lot if you don't have support, you know, to go along with that. I mean, my parents won't see me starve, and they won't see me out on the street. So it's not, you know, that's not a problem for me. But, you know, think of people who are alone, all right, either their family is, they never had a family, their family is not available or doesn't want to be bothered, and they have to depend on public assistance, SSI, and Medicaid. You know, they can't possibly do very well. It's got to be stressful for them, all right. It's a real stressful thing, wondering where your next meal is going to come from. If you're going to have a roof over your head. Simple things, you know, like, can I go to the movies? All right, can I rent a video? You know, can I afford to do that? All right, or if I do that, does that mean maybe I have to miss a meal because I won't have enough money to pay for it? And we all know that stress is devastating on the immune system, and that's the last thing they need.
So what do you think should be different in terms of the way the government or society is dealing with people with AIDS in terms of providing better medical care?
Not just better medical care. I think, and it's so hard, you know, people are people. And quite frankly, AIDS, yes, there is a stigma to AIDS because it's sexually transmitted. But people in general are not too receptive when it comes to disease in general. I remember a time when there was a stigma to cancer. When if you had cancer, you tried to hide it. You know, I know a lot of people you talk to, you hear about, you observe people who, if somebody they know gets sick, they won't go to the hospital because they don't want to be around sick people. People in general, a lot of times, don't deal with people being ill very well. And they have, and their attitude towards a person that's ill, towards whatever the person may be ill with, can sometimes lend stress to the situation. And how do you change an attitude? All right, how do you tell people, hey, you should show a little more compassion, have a little better understanding? How do you do that to people? How do you give them that? You know, you don't.
Do you think the government's doing enough for the issue for AIDS and people with AIDS?
No. All right. No, I don't think that they're doing enough. I'm a child of the 60s. I'm very suspicious of the government. I'm always one that believes that a lot of what could be done isn't being done because somebody is making money off of it. All right. That's because I'm a child of the 60s, and I know what the, you know, how the government lied to us and you know, didn't do things or did things that were only on the surface for our benefit, and really it was, you know, some friend of somebody's who was making money off it. So I've always had that suspicion. I don't think I'll ever get rid of it. As always, like I said, again, I think money that could be spent, money has to go to research, definitely. But what about the people who are now ill? You know, when I first came from the hospital, and I said, I couldn't take care of myself. I could barely walk. I needed help getting to the bathroom, something simple like that. I needed help washing myself. I couldn't cook. Cooking was out of the question. I tried to get visiting nurse services, all right, 6 hours a week. That is absolute nonsense. You know, 6 hours a week? So which means that she came, she helped me bathe, she helped me go to the bathroom, all right. I was staying with a friend, so my friend cooked, but my appetite was horrible, you know. So I wasn't really eating. I was living on Ensure, you know. But there were no support services. What happens if a person comes from the hospital and is too weak, all right, to effectively take care of themselves? There's no support service where you can send in someone to be there. You know, for maybe you have to send three people on 3 8-hour shifts. That person may need 24-hour care for a while. After a while, maybe they don't need that much. But, you know, like I said, that's what I found, that I wasn't able to. That's one of the reasons I'm back in New York. I could not take care of myself. And the services just weren't there. You know, so I had to come back. My family had to do it. You know, and that, you know, they need to look at the care, you know. All right, if the person can't live, if you can't set it up, you don't have enough people, you don't have the manpower, then set up hospices where people can go to recuperate. You know, a hospice just shouldn't be a place where you go to die. You know, why not, you know, set up a place where they can go to get well until they can take care of themselves, you know.
I wanted to get back to a little bit more some of the personal stuff about you. We didn't talk about, and this could be, you might want to talk about this, but how has having AIDS affected your sexual life or not affected your sexual life? Or?
Technically, it hasn't affected my sexual life because my sexual life had died. It had been dead anyway before that, and I just never had a chance to resurrect it. And I'm just now starting to be well enough to where my body is now starting to, you know, think about, hey, maybe I would like to get sexually active again. So that, you know, and I know that that that's going to be a concern. You know, concern, putting it mildly, right? I mean, how do you tell somebody who indicates that they may be interested in you, and then you have to tell them, you know, before we get into this, I have to let you know I have AIDS, so that, you know, this is not just real easy, you know, and how are they going to react? I don't know. I haven't come up against the situation. And I don't know that I ever will. You know, I don't know. I mean, I haven't met anybody that I'm interested in. All right, so I don't know what my reaction is going to be. Maybe I won't want to expose myself like that. Maybe I won't want to take the chance and face the possible rejection, you know. So I don't know. But like I said, hey, my sex life died in 1987, and you know, whether it'll ever come back to life, I don't know. If it does, it'll be fine, you know. If it doesn't, I'll deal with that too.
Well, especially as a heterosexual black woman living in Brooklyn, what kind of message about sexuality and what people should be doing would you like to give, especially to the teenagers, you know, the younger people?
You know, as well, again, I say you can't. I remember growing up in the 50s and 60s, and it is pretty unrealistic to tell teenagers, especially once they start hitting 16, 17, not to have sex. That it is the rule a lot of times rather than the exception. I mean, I waited till I was 18, and a lot of my friends thought I was stupid to have waited, you know. So you have to, you know, they have to be able to talk about it. You have to destigmatize sex. See, that is the big problem. All right, sex is still dirty. All right.
Okay.
All right. You know, marriage. Sex within marriage or a monogamous relationship becomes okay because you're in love, so you can't help yourself, or you're married, so it's allowed, all right? Until sex itself is destigmatized, is made not bad, you know, people are not going to talk to each other about it. People are not going to communicate. People are still going to want to be swept away. And they're still going to talk about spontaneity, all right? Because all of that says that I wasn't in control. My emotions overwhelmed me, all right? And it's rather than say, you know, I wanted to make love to this person, so I made love to them, you know, responsibly. I don't mean to take the joy and the real spontaneity out of it. All right, but if children are brought up, and let's face it, the message is given that sex is something wrong. All right, and if children are brought up like that, then it's hard to get them to use a condom. All right, and it's hard to get two people to talk to each other about what they're feeling. All right, because, you know, the world says they're not really supposed to be feeling that. You know, it's something that you can't help, but you should control. All right, and again, you know, should you necessarily, I mean, there has to be control in everything. I don't advocate in any aspect of your life that you should allow things to get out of control. But should you stifle, you know, the things you feel, there should be some place, somebody you should be able to talk to. And I think that if kids can talk about it, you know, then they can delay it a little longer. You know, when they finally do, it's because this is what I want to do. And they can act responsibly and use a condom because, yes, it can happen to you. You know, and it's not just AIDS, all right? There's unwanted pregnancy, There's syphilis and gonorrhea, and all the, quote, minor sexually transmitted diseases.
Sure.
You know?
You were talking also about the African-American community, particularly in Brooklyn, and people's prejudices and stuff.
Our community is different in a lot of ways. There isn't the stigma attached to unwed motherhood that there is in the Caucasian community, all right? At least there wasn't. Up until recently, when a woman had a child, whether she was married or not, the child was wanted, loved, taken care of. Fathers and brothers and uncles would step in to be the role model. I don't know whether it's the stress of modern society or what has happened, but you know that isn't there anymore. So literally children are being brought up by children with nobody to help them. And we're turning out monsters, and I think in a few years we're going to see the results of a certain amount of selfishness. You know, when I was growing up I grew up on this block, as long as there was a parent home on the block, every child had a parent home. That parent would be guardian to every child on the block, all right? And there was a certain safety in that. You know, nobody could come on the block, and no adult, no stranger could come on the block and say, do something to me, if there was any parent around. Because they, you know, like, who are you? Right? Today, they could snatch a kid screaming, yelling, you're not my mother, leave me alone, and people would stand and watch. They would all be witnesses, but nobody would help the kid. All right? And like I said, I don't know what that is. I don't know what causes that. But there's just a dislocation of people.
In terms of age, you've been telling me about some ways in which you thought that the African American community was having more difficulties or dealing with certain things about sexuality.
Well, first of all, the African American community, I think, is a little more homophobic. Not that society at large isn't homophobic, but the African American community is homophobic. Gays do stay more in the closet. All right. It has to do with how people view manhood and what a man is and what a man is supposed to do and supposed to be. And I think any community where there is a sense of being robbed of your manhood from an outside source, because, you know, our men do feel like society in general is always attacking their manhood. So that when a man supposedly voluntarily relinquishes it, all right, there's the other men kind of like, you know, how could you give it up, all right? It's under attack anyway. You know, they're trying to take it from you. You know, how could you just give it up? How could you be less than a man? You know, so there is that stigma. So, and you have, you know, like I said, I'm sure you have it, you know, in society at large, where gay men, you know, get married and have children, and yet on the outside have homosexual relationships. But like I said, in the African American community, homosexual men do tend to stay much more in the closet, and they will go outside of the neighborhood, you know, for any relationships or liaisons. It also means that those that are HIV positive or have AIDS are going outside the neighborhood for services. You know, when feel that they're unable to get support from their friends and neighbors, and you get isolated because you don't know anybody else with AIDS that lives near you. You know, everybody is like scattered, and you get a real sense of being one of very few people in the situation, even though you hear on TV and you read in the newspapers that there is a growing population of people with AIDS, people who are HIV positive. But for the most part, you're not meeting them. You know, so you don't get that sense that you're not alone in this. You know, you very much feel isolated.
And how have you feel, has AIDS really affected your community right here, the Crown Heights area, and how people responded to Caribbean Women's Health and stuff?
You know, again, everybody is into not me, all right? Again, how do you change people's beliefs? How do you break a long-held belief? And there's still a definite belief that AIDS is a disease of gay men and IV drug users. And if you're not gay and you don't use drugs, you're not at risk. All right? And this stigma is not me. People don't even want to get... It's like even going and getting tested, admitting that you may be at risk, stigmatizes you. All right, so people don't even want to get tested. A lot of these people will have to have symptoms before they're tested. All right, and even then, you know, you can't be tested against your will, so they may refuse to be tested. You know, and then when you have our neighborhood is poorer than most, so that a lot of we don't go to the doctor for periodic checkups. You know, if we can afford it, all right. And even if we're on public assistance and Medicaid is paying for it, doctor's offices are like clinics. And who wants to sit 3 or 4 hours to wait to see a doctor if there's nothing wrong with you? All right. So you don't go to the doctor till you get sick. And if you can't go to the neighborhood, then you go to Kings County Hospital or you go to Interfaith. You know, you go to one of the hospitals and use the emergency room as your doctor. So a lot of times these people will not find out that they're even positive until they're already in ARC, if they're lucky. If not, they'll be full blown before they realize they've got anything. And they may have passed it on to who knows how many other people. Or if it's a woman, she may have passed it on to children. You know, she may find out then. You know, she'll get pregnant and she'll have a baby. All right, I don't know if they automatically test them when they're pregnant. You know, or she'll have a baby and the baby will come out positive or with AIDS. And then she'll find out that she's been infected.
What do you think needs to happen here in Brooklyn, in the African American community, to change all that?
You know, the only thing you can do is just keep the information coming, all right? And again, you know, it's so hard to change people's, you know, there is this taboo, this looking down on people who have AIDS, and how do you change that attitude? And unfortunately, the way the attitude may change is that so many people may come up sick, may come up infected and sick, that, you know, once it starts to affect you personally, your attitude changes real quick. You know, it turns around real quick when the involvement is personal. And unfortunately, that's what may happen. The involvement may become personal. If it's not you, it'll be somebody you love or somebody you know and care about, you know, and that'll change it.
Mm. You said you got involved with the Caribbean Women's Health Association.
I'm on their.
You say what they are.
Oh, they're.
I'm trying to get you to say them. You got to say the name.
Oh, Caribbean. Oh, Caribbean Women's Health Association. I'm sorry. They deal with issues affecting Caribbean Americans, immigration, health care. And of course, AIDS is also a major factor. There are a lot of Haitians in Crown Heights, and they were one of the groups that were first specified as a target group. You know, they are disproportionately affected by AIDS. so that you know, they sort of set up to offer these services to the Crown Heights community. And like I said, there's a large Caribbean population in this community, you know, from all over the West Indies.
And you've gotten involved with them?
I've gotten involved as I'm on their program committee. And you know, I'm there mainly for advice, you know, how am I affected by AIDS, things that concern me that I can put them, you know, give them information about, programs that they're thinking of starting or have ongoing, where they, you know, let me read up on it and say, well, is there anything we missed? Is there something more we need to do? All right, or is there something we need to stop doing or stop saying? All right, you know, things like that. The committee meets every 3 months, and you know, again, we just sort of look over their program, the program they have in place, and you know, tinker with it to see to get it to work a little better.
Okay, as we didn't talk too much about what you're doing for yourself medically right now.
All right. I go to a regular medical doctor. I'm taking AZT for the virus. I'm taking Bactrim so that I don't get pneumonia again. I haven't had a lot of trouble. I've had an ear infection, so I had to take medicine for that. Every once in a while, I get oral thrush, or I've had a couple of vaginal yeast infections, so I take medicine for that, but I don't have to take medicine all the time for yeast or fungal infections. Like I said, God has been good. I've been doing pretty well, you know, since I've gotten sick, and I don't take a whole lot of medicines. I do take herbal supplements. Of course, I take vitamins and iron, because, you know, but I do take herbal supplements to help my immune system. I go to an herbalist, and he's giving me a mixture of herbs with antivirals, antibiotics, tonic, you know, for my energy and stamina. You know, and I make a tea, I drink it twice a day. It is absolutely horrible, but I drink it twice a day. You know, just in general, trying to, you know, take care of myself, keep informed on what things are happening as far as medicine is concerned, and try to eat well and get enough rest, you know. So you should do this anyway. But now it becomes critical, you know, so you do it.
And yeah. Before you mentioned, you kind of touched on the issue that women often have different symptoms and get diagnosed later.
Women, from what I understand, from the information I have, usually the first signs that women have are recurring yeast infections. I don't know that many women that have AIDS. I can only think of one offhand, and at the time she hadn't gone full blown yet. She was still in ARC, and the reason she was tested is because, as a healthcare worker, she decided to be tested periodically, and they found out she was positive. And I'm trying to think, I can't remember what symptoms she got in ARC. But basically speaking, what happens is women get recurring yeast infections. By the time a lot of women know that they've been infected, they were already full-blown. You know, we don't get a lot of things like, supposedly we don't get the KS, Kaposi sarcoma, that men get. We don't get that, at least not so far. But then women are a new group, really. You know, so what are manifestations are is not all that clear, because we're still coming up, and you know, they're still finding out things about us. you know, and how AIDS affects us, because it does affect women differently than it does men.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, or especially like any message you'd like to give if people are going to be picking up a phone and hearing your voice at the exhibit? What is like the kind of one thing you'd like to say to people?
I would love to tell them to get tested. You know, I would love to tell them to be more responsible.
Do you want to get it and hang on for 5 seconds?
Yeah, come here.
Okay, you were saying you read the message you were just speaking.
Oh.
But to actually say it like as if you're telling them, so I said I would like to tell them. It's like if you're talking to a group of people at the exhibit, telling them, get tested, get...
I would advise, please get tested. Because the earlier, if you happen to be positive, the earlier you find out, the longer you can live, the quicker they can treat you, and the longer you can live. I also want to say, please don't walk around paranoid. All right? Because even if you are positive, and so you know your lifespan has been shortened, there's still a lot of life left and a lot of joy to be derived from it. And don't walk around paranoid and depressed and you know, hey, if you get sick, you know, there are services out there that will help you. And like I said, life is still good. You know, it's still fun. There's still very good times to be had. You know, there's no reason to be hopeless or helpless or anything like that.
Was that your mom came in?
That was my mother, yes.
Just a question, your family that never acts irrationally scared about you in terms of catching it or anything, they've never got any of that?
No. That chicken she came and got, I didn't cook it because she was I was in Canada at the time, but I was the one that seasoned it, which means that I had to pull off the skin. I touched it. All right, I added the seasoning. I cook, they eat. You know what I mean?
You never experienced any of that from any?
No. All right, they made it their business. My mother's a nurse. My mother's an RN, so she knew. All right, and they made it their business to find out. All right, so that I mean, things, even simple things like say when my brother comes, my sister works. I have a sister also. She works afternoons. Now my brother may come in, and my sister's probably now next door, getting a shower, to go to work. So if my brother comes in, he may have to use the bathroom. He'll use my bathroom, no problem at all. You know what I mean? When he comes in, I mean, you know, he hugs and kisses me. You know, that we touch each other. There's no, like I said, whatever stigma they may feel, all right, it is a conscious decision on their part that will not be communicated to me. All right, so I really don't get that. And like I said, as far as that's concerned, you know, my mother and now that I'm well and able to do it, my mother and I share the cooking. All right, and nobody, you know, nobody's like, oh, well, she cooked this, I'm not going to eat it. No, it's not a problem. Oh. You know, yeah.
Great. I can't leave it on.
All right.
Here, I have to ask you a couple of extra questions, but thank you.
Is there anything around your house now that is different? Did you live in here before?
I was in California when I got sick.
Right.
All right.
Where in California were you?
Long Beach.
Long Beach?
Yeah.
And you were in Long Beach for a total of?
I had been in Long Beach for about 2.5 years.
Okay. And you moved out there sort of as a result to get away from this guy?
Partly to get away from him. And you know, when there's been... A lot of times when there's been a personal upheaval in your life, a change of scenery, you know, seems like a thing that you can deal with, yeah.
And you had been an administrative assistant here as well?
Yes.
Yeah. Is it in a hospital or in a...
No, business. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I worked for a bank before I went out. I worked temporary. I had a job at an aerospace company, But then 6 months after I got hired, they started laying off, you know, so that, so for the most part, I've been working temporary.
So pretty much all you just have done the same type of administrative work, but
yeah,
company.
Yes.
And did you grow up here in Crown Heights, or did you?
Yes, I, well.
Oh, you said in this neighborhood.
Yeah, in fact, in my grandfather bought this house in the 50s. So that I've been living in this house just about since then.
Has anything in this house changed? You can look around and say, that's here because I have AIDS, you know, or whether it's a picture or, you know, is there anything physical in here?
I tell you what's not here. There are no rugs, for the most part, like carpeting, wall-to-wall carpeting. There's none of that because of it holds dust, and especially my lungs with the pneumonia. All right, it's a source of germs and dust, so there's never going to be any carpeting.
Did you have it taken up? Or was it in here?
It wasn't here. It was suggested that I get it because the, you know, carpeting makes the floors a little warmer, and then, you know, I had to say that no, you know. Can't have it. All right. It's not there now because it's warm, so heat isn't coming up. But I kept a pan of water on the radiator because I was because we'd get very, the heat was very dry, and I can't get a humidifier because not just the water pan in the humidifier, but all the pipes and all that stuff. Fungus grows on that, and I cannot. Again, I have no defense against it. Hmm. All right. See, for a regular person, that wouldn't be a problem. But for me, it's a problem because I have no defense.
How about as far as your, do you, your, is that a nightgown and a, I mean, I can't tell what you have on.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I'll tell you, like, I'm getting rid of this couch because I don't know what it is, but my skin has gotten very sensitive. All right, so I stick a lot with cotton and smooth fabrics without a lot of lint and nap, because usually when I sit on this for any length of time, I put a cotton sheet on it, because it really makes my skin itch, you know. And I do find that my skin is very dry, and it is sensitive to materials. You know, the reason I had on this is because I didn't get up till after 10, and there just wasn't time to really, you know, fix clothes and get dressed, because I thought you were going to be here in about 15 minutes. That's why I'm not dressed.
So your workdays, you used to sleep until, like, you get up at 7 or 6 or?
About 6. I usually get up about 6. Well, in California, especially because of the 3-hour time difference, most jobs start at 7:30, 8 o'clock. So I'd have to be out of the house by 7 o'clock to get to work on time.
And so now, do you normally sleep until 10?
Now I'm making out like a bandit. I usually get up usually according to when I go to bed the night before. Last night I went to bed at a fairly reasonable hour. So I actually got up about 6. I was hungry, so I got up. I had some yogurt and some fruit. And I took my morning vitamins and medicine and things like that. And I went back to bed. Now, a lot of times what I'll do is I'll get up. I'll do that. I'll watch cartoons. All right, and then I'll go back to bed for another 3 or 4 hours, you know.
What the extent of the vitamins and medicines, about how many total would you say you take now? I mean, how many different types of vitamins, how many different types of medicines?
Okay, I take AZT 4 times a day. I take Bactrim once a day. I take, it's a one-a-day vitamin. I take, a multivitamin once a day. I take iron. An iron tablet once a day, and then my tea I drink twice a day, and then the herbs, the golden seal and the immune action herbs that I take them with every meal. You know, so sometimes I've got like 7 or 8 pills in my hand, especially with the morning meal. I take the most because that's when I take my vitamin, my iron, my Bactrim I take in the morning. And of course, well, the AZT I take with every meal plus an extra one before I go to bed.
Your newsletter, do you know when it's going to start?
All I'm doing now is collecting information and trying to get somebody to help me to read it, digest it, and put it out in some kind of a form. Also, you know, there's no, at least I can't find one, and probably I just don't know where to look. There's no, like, clearinghouse for information. You know, you have to, information comes from all over. Nobody, there's no one or two or three agencies that's getting, you know, information. I mean, you know, information is being published in magazines, in newspapers. The CDC is putting things out. The AMA is putting things out. Different organizations are putting things out. And there's nobody's getting everything. So you just call and write a bunch of different people and say, you know, can you send me this information on a monthly basis? And then, quite frankly, so far I've just gotten so much information. You know, I'm just in the process of trying to read and digest it for myself, and then, you know, access to a PC, and getting another person to help me, you know, get this together.
You said you've gotten so much information. How many different types of mailings are you getting?
I'm getting something from Gay Men's Health Crisis. I'm getting something from Body Positive. There's the Brooklyn AIDS Task Force. There's Project Inform out on the coast. A lot of it I don't have here. I brought it down to the Caribbean Women's. Who else? PWA. There's an organization called PWA that I've gotten information from.
Did you say a half dozen or a dozen?
Yeah, a half dozen at least. And then when you call them, they refer you to others, so you know, you make more phone calls.
How much of your day do you think you spend sort of looking around for information?
I don't spend more than 2 or 3 hours a day, you know, calling. And again, you know, I'm just starting to get a lot more mobile than I was. All right, so I know I'm probably going to have to go and sit in a library, you know, and just look up information and write down or make copies of as much as I can.
Have you changed physically at all? Can you look at yourself and say?
I think so.
And how would you say?
I think that I look older. I think, especially like around my eyes. You know, I think I look older. One thing, having been in the hospital and having tubes in my throat for 10 days, my voice has changed. My voice strength has changed. There are times when I get very hoarse and have problems talking. Not bad problems, you know, but you know, you have to pull and clear your throat because there's a hoarseness there. I was never a great singer, but I find that it's difficult. Singing is now very difficult for me, you know. And like I said, I was never a great singer. I mean, we're talking about, you know, in the shower and with records, but now I find I can't do that, all right, because it's actually a strain on my throat. But that's a direct result of having those tubes in my throat for 10 days, you know. And again, well, the medicine makes me anemic. I can't smoke anymore, of course. I was a smoker until I got the pneumonia, so I don't smoke anymore. Not that there are times when I would love a cigarette, but, you know, you just can't. You know, I know my lungs and my throat would just never handle it. You know, again, my skin. I use things like Lubriderm and Keri and mineral oil on my skin, and just a year ago, I couldn't dare put Keri on my skin because my skin had enough oil in it that if I put Keri on my skin, it would actually be slippery. It would be so oily. And now my skin just soaks it in.
Do you have a bunch of bottles by your bed, or where do you keep going?
Well, if you look at my bathroom, you see all kinds of oils and things for my skin. After I bathe, you know, like I have to put mineral oil and all over my skin because like it's very dry and it itches. Well, I'm also slightly allergic to the Bactrim, so that too causes an itch, you know.
Have your circle of friends changed?
I think, well, you know, the thing is, see, I'm back in New York now, and there are a few friends I had here. Of course, the friends in California, I don't hear from them as much. It's the time difference, the fact that I'm just not physically there anymore, and their lives go on. All right, you know how you I really don't think it has anything to do with my having AIDS. I think it has something to do with my being 2,500 miles away and probably will not ever be back in California. All right? And then you pick up the friendships that kind of lapsed here. And, I mean,
What was that like for you coming back here? And I mean, you basically, your friends were going, hey, why haven't you come home?
Came home to die. All right, you know, I came home. I came home because I couldn't, like I said, I couldn't take care of myself. I was too weak at the time. And now that I'm here, let's face it, I'm going to be sick again. When, I don't know. I'm going to try and stay as healthy as I can for as long as I can. But, you know, the virus marches on, and eventually I'm going to be sick again. And if I'm going to be sick again, I want to be with my family. I want to be where my family can be around. And it cost a lot of money to on a moment's notice get plane reservations and fly from here across the country. All right, and then there's the time, there's the whole logistics involved, you know. Well, my mom works only part time now, but still, she does work. She does have a job. How much time can you take off all the time, you know? If somebody's sick, my sister works, my brother works, you know. If I'm here in Brooklyn, when I get sick again, it's much easier to lend me that physical to support. Also, the money that is spent flying back and forth across the country could be used for something else, you know. So
when you have your friends in the street or friends from high school or whatever, do you talk to them?
For the most, a lot of them since those people that were close to me that we maintained the relationship even when I was in California. All right, they know. They know that I have AIDS, and they understand why I'm home. Those people that are more or less acquaintances, oh, yes, I went to school with you, and I see you every 3 or 4 years, a lot of them didn't even know I was in California because we didn't, you know, yes, we knew each other in high school, but we grew up. We grew apart. All right, and we're not enemies, certainly. And if we see each other, you know, we catch up a little bit, but we didn't have that day-to-day friendship relationship. So for the most part, they just know I was sick and that I'm home, and they accept that.
Where did you go to high school around here?
Out in the Bronx. I went to Bronx High School of Science.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
That's a great school.
Yeah, it was all right.
And did you end up going to college?
I went to Manhattan Community College.
Did you go all 4 years, or?
No, I went for 2 years. It's a community college. I got an AA degree.
Oh, right. I'm sorry. An AA, and what was your?
Business Administration.
And have you ever been married, or?
No. Mm-hmm.
And this was a guy that you knew growing up, or?
I met him, I was working at a taxi service, and I met him there.
Do you year it was?
It was probably 69, because we knew each other for a while before we got involved. So it was probably 1969.
Was he a driver?
He was an owner-driver, yeah. He owned about 3 or 4 cars. You know, he drove one and, you know, hired drivers to drive the others.
Was that here in Brooklyn?
Yeah.
What, in Crown Heights, or?
Yeah, Crown Heights, Bedford Stuyvesant, Black Pearl.
How do you feel about him and about... And you basically dated on and off for 17 years?
No,
we
were straight for 17 years.
Like, lived here?
No, we didn't live together. I always maintained my own apartment. I spent a great deal of time with him. Most weekends, we spent in one place or the other together. But for the most part, you know, like I said, we each maintained our own residence for 17 years.
Do you have any children?
No. No, he has, but I don't have any.
How do you sort of feel about him and about the...
Again, the animosity and the hostility has been there since we broke up, because, I mean, the breakup was bad. And so I, there is, you know, every now and then I feel angry. You know, I say to myself, look what he did to me. You know, but I try to, you know, get up off that, because again, I have to keep repeating. He did not go out there seeking, looking for getting AIDS, all right? Because he certainly didn't want it, you know. And I'm sure, you know, whatever happened between us, he didn't want to give that to me, all right? So it's not, you know. But yes, I do get angry about it, you know. But then again, you know, when we broke up, I didn't want him in my life anymore anyway, all right? So this didn't add to the situation, you know. And we've had no contact. I thought hard about that. I thought about, you know, going over and saying to him, you know, I'm sick also. And then I said, well, you know, if I hadn't gotten sick, all right, if I hadn't gotten AIDS, I wouldn't have had anything to do with him anyway. So, you know, I don't see any reason to, you know.
So you haven't told him?
He was diagnosed before I was.
Or he doesn't know. You haven't told him that you have.
No, him. Not that I, unless New York City Department of Health, because that was the reason they called, was to tell New York City Department of Health and ask them to contact him and let him know. All right. Whether they did or not, I don't know. Maybe they felt they didn't have to, since he was already diagnosed.
You mean they ask you who your partner's been?
In California, they asked me, yes. And they also got my permission. I mean, they said, you know, do you want him contacted? Can we, you know, do you want us to, do you want to do it yourself? Or do you want us to get in touch with New York City or New York State? I don't know which agency does it, but and ask them, would they contact him, you know, and let him know. And I said, you know, if you would get in touch with them. And again, I was telling him, see, I don't know, I'm gonna tell you right now, I don't know what the legal protocol is. I don't know if the person that gave the information was giving it on an official basis, or whether it was because they knew each other and it was two colleagues talking privately. What I'm trying to say is, I don't know if it was legal for the person in New York to tell the person in California that he had been diagnosed. So I would rather, before you put something like that and maybe start some kind of problem for somebody, I'd rather you found out whether or not they could.
I think for my purposes, I would just say she found out.
Okay,
I don't want to get into all the details. And you said that you don't know a lot of other people around here. Is your mother has a more of an accent than you do? Is she Caribbean? Are you Caribbean?
Yes. See, I came up as a baby. I was born in Grenada, but I came as a baby. I was 10 months old. My mom, of course, grew up there. My father did too, but he has less of an accent.
You were born in Grenada, lived there till you were 10, and then moved?
10 months.
Oh, 10 months. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And your parents had come here because of jobs or because of...
All right. My grandparents came. My father's parents came in the 20s. My father was born here, but he was born around the time of the Depression. So he and my aunt, his sister, were sent back to grow up there so that my grandmother could go to work. All right, so he was raised there by his grandmother. Now, of course, when he reached a certain age, he had to come back or else lose his, or else have a problem with his citizenship. So he came back, and of course, by this time, they were married. My mother was expecting me. She couldn't travel then, so he came. And then once she had me and could make the arrangements, then she came and brought me.
Okay, so now being with the Caribbean women, I mean, that's very natural for you because...
Yes, yes.
Is this neighborhood mostly Caribbean?
Oh, yes, it's a big Caribbean neighborhood. There are a lot of Latinos in the neighborhood also. But it's a major Caribbean neighborhood. And in fact, if you're going back to the subway, if you walk along Schenectady Avenue and you look in the fruit and vegetable stands, you'll see a lot of, you know, things that you probably, what the hell is that? And it's Caribbean, you know. And the supermarkets, you know, you can go in the supermarkets and get things from the Caribbean. In fact, a lot of times the remark is made that things that you can't get in the Caribbean, you can get here, and you can buy it here and send it back for them to use. Yes.
Do you find that you get stereotyped at all? If I mean, a lot of the, you sort of addressed this before, but a lot of the women who have AIDS are have it because of prostitution or IV drug use. Do you feel you're just a tiny minority having to fight to say, look, you know, I'm like totally normal? And
you know, I'm gonna tell you something, all right? At the very beginning, when you first get told, telling people how you got it, making them understand that you're not an IV drug user or a prostitute or anything like that is important. But now, a few months down the line, I can't give it back wherever I got it. You know, and it's good to know so that you can tell somebody, all right, so that you can use that experience and tell somebody. But other than that, it's not really important. And the people that know, so far it's not, you know, it's, I'm not, as you can see, I'm not in the public yet. I'm not yet public with it. So the people that know me. So it never occurred to them, you know, first of all, it never occurred to them that I could get AIDS. Because, see, they know me. They've known me for a while. They know that there's been him and only him. All right? So, you know, it was like, you? You know, and then immediately, when I told them that I had AIDS, they called his name immediately. And they knew he must have done something. All right? It wasn't, there wasn't even the question of how you got it. It's how did he get it to give it to you. All right? So that... My relatives, my friends, their attitude toward me is a little different. You know, I'm sure once I start meeting more people, meeting more strangers, I noticed that there were a couple of people in the hospital when I was sick that had that kind of an attitude, and it did bother me. But I go for counseling every week, and I talked, and my counselor and I, you know, have talked about that.
He's
a social worker, and he works with people with Interfaith Hospital has what they call the special treatment unit, and what it is a counseling service for people who are HIV positive or have AIDS. So you go there once a week and you sit and talk with somebody about any and everything you want to.
And how long are your sessions?
An hour a week.
And does it help you?
Yes, because